Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. Amid all of the unknowns around coronavirus, there's one thing that scientists know will slow the spread, and that's wearing a face mask in public, properly over your nose and mouth. The CDC has called on Americans to wear face masks and said that if almost everyone wore a cloth face covering, the virus could be contained in a matter of weeks. But according to a CDC survey from May, about a quarter of people said they would not follow recommendations to wear a face mask when outside the home. So how do we persuade people, both in our lives and in our communities, to wear a mask? And is there perhaps a missed opportunity for a public health ad campaign around this? We're joined now by Jason Harris. He's CEO of Mechanism, a creative ad agency with offices in Chicago, New York, San Francisco, and Seattle. He's in New York. They help companies develop and brand their message. He's also the author, recently, of The Soulful Art of Persuasion, The 11 Habits That Will Make Anyone a Master Influencer. His agency worked on the Obama administration's It's On Us campaign to stop sexual assault. Jason, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
I'd also like to welcome Laura Bogart. She's a PhD, senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation. She's a social psychologist who researches health disparities, particularly the areas of stigma and medical mistrust. Laura, thank you for being with us today.
Thank you so much.
And I'd also like to welcome Northern Illinois University psychology professor Brad Sagarin. He teaches, or I should say his research interests, include social influence and resistance to persuasion. Brad, thanks for being here on the 21st as well.
Thank you. Great to be here.
And listeners, we, in order to make the schedules work, we pre-taped this conversation, but we still always want to hear what you thought about what we're talking about. You can tweet us at 21st Show. That's at 21st Show. You can also always, of course, email us. The address is talk at 21st Show, talk at 21st Show. Brad, I want to start with you. When it comes to persuasion, where do you think persuasion on the mask issue has failed, if it has failed?
Well, I think the biggest problem is that mask wearing has become politicized. It's become a political symbol. Getting people to wear masks shouldn't have been a particularly tough sell. It's not painful. It's mildly inconvenient. And if we had had our leaders speaking with one voice and kind of other people around wearing masks, I think that widespread mask wearing probably would have occurred. Unfortunately, at this point, when people see putting on a mask or refusing to put on a mask as a way of expressing their political stance, that's a tough thing to overcome.
And I guess I'd like the same question. I wonder, Laura, what your perspective is on that. This, you know, this idea that mask wearing has become politicized. Have there been missed opportunities for persuasion?
Yes, I agree with that as well. It's become politicized. And I think also one of the major issues is that it's become inconsistent with the messaging between public health officials, scientists, and our federal officials and local officials. So what we need to do is have a consistent message, and then people would listen more.
And so, Jason, I mean, you're the head of an ad agency, Mechanism. I wonder what you think about the public health ad campaigns. There have been a few, I think, sort of regional approaches. And maybe this is just another failure that I haven't seen a sort of bigger national approach. Have you thought about public health ad campaigns in the context of mask wearing?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think there's one that Andrew Cuomo's done in New York, which is called Mask Up, which I think has been pretty effective. But again, it's regional. And I agree with Brad and Laura that if you don't have one consistent national message, that's where everything falls apart. And as an advertiser, when I look at campaigns and trying to make a national play, you know, there's really three steps. You try to simplify the message. You try to inspire the audience to take action, and then somehow you involve the audience. And if you follow that playbook, everything could have been in a very different place. And I think because there were so many mixed messages early on, it did become politicized, and it almost became, versus one simple message, for example, of it's patriotic to wear a mask and make that the message. Now it's about, based on what party you subscribe to, that's the stance you have. It's about freedom if you don't wear a mask. It's about exercising your freedom versus if you wear a mask, it's about respecting others, for example. There's too many messages versus coming out with one national message to begin with.
Yeah, we actually have an ad from New York queued up here. Let's take a listen to that, and then we can talk about what's going on in this ad.
There's a way to stop the spread of coronavirus. There's a way to protect others. There's a way to keep your family safe. New York figured it out. The answer weighs less than an ounce. It's not a heavy lift.
So Jason, I wonder if you can just sort of respond to that. And what do you hear there? What do you hear maybe that works? Maybe anything that you think might not work in that?
Well, I think it's a strong, clear message. I think it's pretty powerful. It's not particularly memorable, I wouldn't say. So I would try to come up with something that might be a little more hookier to the point. But overall, I think it does its job.
And Laura, I wonder about you from a sort of a behavioral psychology perspective. What do you make of the messaging in that ad that we just heard?
Yes, thanks for asking. I think it sounds powerful and it's speaking to the people. But I also think it's important to point out that we don't need a one-size-fits-all message because every community is different. And the reasons for mistrusting messages around masks and maybe not believing the science may be different by community. So what we need to figure out is what are the trusted information sources in each community and how can we target messages differently by community to get the message across.
Can you talk a little bit more about that? Because I think that idea of trust is pretty important here, right? We're talking about, you know, there's distrust of the medical system in some communities. We had a guest on last week who was saying that a lot of people in the African-American communities around America have a lot of mistrust over generations because of things like the Tuskegee Institute study, where people had an STI, were infected with an STI and left untreated just for experimental purposes without any sort of consent or even knowledge. You have other communities where there's strong distrust of media. And maybe even, you know, friends and family members are viewed with suspicion in this highly polarized era. Can you talk about, you know, finding different people that, you know, some people might trust more than others when trying to get a message out like this?
Yes, I'm so glad you brought up that point because mistrust is very understandable, for example, as you mentioned, in Black communities, especially regarding healthcare and public health messaging, where mistrust has been deeply rooted in systemic racism, including personal experiences with discrimination, as well as knowledge about historical experiences like this Tuskegee syphilis study, as you mentioned, historical unethical medical experimentation, unequal treatment in healthcare. So, and as we know, this mistrust has been heightened even more during the pandemic, especially due to recent events involving police brutality. So then when people in Black communities hear about messages from public health officials or maybe inconsistent messages from the federal government, people may not know what to believe. And so this mistrust may lead to people saying, you know, I'm just not going to get tested. I'm just not going to wear a mask. I don't know what to believe. And what we need to do, as I mentioned, is figure out what are the trusted community information sources to address this mistrust. Not just about mask wearing, but a future vaccine. We need to be laying the groundwork for that and thinking, okay, who in the community can be a good person to deliver testing, to deliver a vaccine when it's available? Who are the trusted people that may not be healthcare providers, maybe churches, maybe local organizations? And that's what we need to do in every community. And it's a lot of work in the short term to figure this out separately for every community, but it will pay off in the long run.
And Brad, just before we move on from this, specifically that New York ad we heard a couple of minutes ago, I wanted to ask you, since you've talked about the politicization here, I mean, that ad doesn't have Governor Andrew Cuomo in it, but it does hold up New York as an example. And I wonder, you know, how you think that might play in other areas of the country. I mean, I can remember not long ago when New York was used as sort of a political epithet. I'm trying to remember the politician who made that sort of famous, infamous comment, depending on one's perspective, famous or infamous, about, you know, New York values. But that was in a recent political campaign cycle.
I think that's a great point and a great question. And I think it really returns to the issues that Laura was bringing up before regarding who is a trusted source. And if an ad like that is playing in a place where New York is looked at negatively, then it could potentially backfire, unfortunately. But I think that really underscores the importance of targeting messages at particular communities that would be receptive to those messages. I do think that one of the things that that ad did well is that it leaves the choice to the listener. We don't like being told what to do. I mean, if you look back at the origin of seatbelts, when seatbelts were first put in place, there was a lot of resistance to, you know, the government can't tell me what to do. And these days, of course, the attitude has completely changed. If I get into the car and don't put on my seatbelt, my kids remind me to put my seatbelt on. So I think that ads that remind the target that they have a choice. They don't, you know, there's nothing we could do to force them to wear a mask, but here's why it would be a good idea for them to do it, can maybe do an end run around that kind of resistance that we put up to people trying to tell us we have no choice.
If you're just tuning in, this is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're having a conversation now about public health persuasion, particularly when it comes to wearing masks. The CDC says mask wearing could drastically slow the spread of coronavirus disease if everyone did it. But we're still seeing that compliance is pretty low in some places. We're talking with Northern Illinois University psychology professor Brad Sagarin. We're also joined by Jason Harris, CEO of the creative ad agency Mechanism, and Laura M. Bogart. She's a senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation. We got quite a few texts from listeners on this topic. Several people mentioned they are sharing the idea of sharing facts with people. Justin from Rockford says, I give them data, the latest stats from the IDPH website, that's the Illinois Department of Public Health. It's very helpful, informative, and apolitical facts. And Lori from Champaign says, quote, I'm medically compromised, so I would start there. Statistics would be the second step. Probably most important, though, would be asking their reasons for not wearing one and trying to understand. Jason, I wonder how effective you think presenting people with the facts might be, right? We're in an era where people tweet out and, you know, hashtag because science or hashtag science, and that's sort of meant as like sort of a mic drop moment. Do you think that's effective?
I think it's effective to a point. I think, you know, depending on the source, because we are in such a low trust era where we, you know, there's fake news, depending on what news source you listen to, that's the information and the data that you believe. I always find it's more powerful. The mind is a story processor, not a logic processor. So what we remember are stories that are told. I think stats and information and data, while it's important because it roots us in science, I think it kind of goes in and out. And when you you're watching the news now, it looks like it's just numbers. There's no real context to the numbers. So I really find to persuade people to wear masks, I think using personal stories and talking about respect or how it might affect a loved one, or do you care about the people in your community? I think using those stories would be more powerful than just data and stats that are, you know, sort of you question the source and where they're coming from and what's behind those numbers. I always find that stories are more powerful.
I'm glad you mentioned stories, because we got a voice memo from a listener on this topic, Jennifer Ludwig in Rochester, which is a town just outside Springfield. Here's what she had to say.
Hi, my name is Jen, and I live in Rochester. I encourage people to wear a mask because it is not about them. It is about the people around them and who they come into contact with. My husband is an essential worker, and he could be exposed from someone who does not wear a mask and bring this virus home to our 7-year-old son, who was born with a congenital heart defect. While our son is overall healthy, he will need a valve replacement in the future, and being exposed to this virus could have devastating effects on him, including death, as this virus attacks the heart, lungs, and blood vessels. This virus does not care about politics or individual liberties, so please wear a mask.
So Jason, I wonder, what do you think about that sort of the storytelling aspect of that there in terms of trying to convince people why they ought to wear masks?
Yeah, so I find that to be incredibly powerful, very memorable. It humanizes the issue with a story and someone that you know, you don't know who that person is, the listener, but you can relate to that story and you can remember, oh, I should be protecting, you know, her her husband and son who has a, you know, frontline worker, and her son who has, you know, compromised immune system. And so that touches people's hearts in a way that I think data and logic can't. Obviously you need to do a mixture of both, but having that almost as a communication device and having many stories, back to what Laura was saying, even having those targeted in specific communities would be really powerful. And I think the next thing, not to jump ahead, but the next thing we almost have to look towards beyond masks is how we're going to get people to want to get a vaccine. Because I think the mask thing is almost irreparable in a way. I mean, we can get people to start wearing masks, hopefully. But the next fight we're going to have is how we're going to get people to take the vaccine.
And I want to put a pin in that question about the vaccine for a second. We need to take a break here. We've been speaking with Jason Harris. He's the CEO of Mechanism, a creative ad agency, as well as Laura Bogart, a behavioral scientist at the Rand Corporation, a PhD social psychologist, and Northern Illinois University psychology professor Brad Sagarin, whose research interests include social influence and resistance to persuasion. And we're going to continue this conversation in a moment. I also want to remind our listeners, we did read a few texts in our conversation so far. And if you are interested in becoming a part of that, having your text read on air, you can join our group. It's called Text the 21st. It helps shape our coverage on the show. You can become part of the conversation by answering weekly questions sent to your phone. Join by texting the word TALK to 217-803-0730. Once again, it's TALK, T-A-L-K, to 217-803-0730. This week, our question was, hypothetically, or maybe not, how would you encourage a loved one to follow public health guidelines like masking? This is the 21st. More to come after a quick break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about masking and persuasion in a public health context more broadly. We're speaking with Jason Harris. He's the CEO of Mechanism, a creative ad agency. They have offices in New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Seattle. He's also the author of The Soulful Art of Persuasion, The 11 Habits That Will Make Anyone a Master Influencer. His agency worked on the Obama administration's It's On Us campaign to stop sexual assault. We're also with Laura Bogart. She's a PhD social psychologist and a senior behavioral scientist at the Rand Corporation. And Brad Sagarin, who's a professor in psychology at Northern Illinois University. He researches social influence and resistance to persuasion. Before the break, we were talking about masking mostly, but it was sort of a prelude to another persuasion fight we're going to have in the future, which is vaccines, right? Assuming, hoping we can get a vaccine that's effective for COVID-19, how are we going to convince people to take it? Laura, you alluded to this a little earlier. Can you talk about, you know, some of the resistance to vaccines that are out there with existing vaccines for diseases that, you know, have been long established? The vaccines are much more established. Some of them have been around for decades.
Yes, absolutely. There's a lot of anti-vaccine movements in the country. There's people who believe that vaccines may cause harmful effects and don't want to take them, or simply don't trust them, don't think that they've been tested enough, feel like people are being treated as guinea pigs who take them. And so we've seen this already. And now we're hearing in communities another conversation about a potential coronavirus vaccine. And what we're hearing is things like, oh, it's political. They're just trying to rush the scientific process through. They're not testing it fully. I don't want to be the guinea pig who takes it. So we're hearing a lot of that right now. And I think knowing this, knowing that this is out there, this mistrust is real and out there, it's going to be a barrier. We need to think now about strategies about how to overcome it.
Well, what are some of, I mean, I don't know if you have the answers. I feel like this is one of those issues that it seems like the more you try and convince people, in some ways, the more hardened they become in their beliefs or fears.
Absolutely. I think one of the issues is that when you tell people to do something, their reaction may be, no, I don't want to do it. So what we've talked about in psychology is more of a conversational style called motivational interviewing. It's a psychological technique. It's a non-confrontational, non-judgmental style of communication that can be used between two people, for example, healthcare provider and patient, or just with your friends and family. And it's where you actively listen to, you know, why do they have these reasons for mistrust? What are they thinking? And you listen to them, you hear them out, you acknowledge there actually are reasons for mistrust and worry. You know, is this vaccine going to be scientifically sound? And so people have these questions and we listen to the questions and do more listening than talking. And the important thing is not to tell the other person what to do and think, because that has never worked. I mean, when you think about it, if someone tells you what to do, without telling you reasons, without listening, without hearing you, you know, you're not inclined to do it. So we use these motivational interviewing techniques to kind of sensitively acknowledge why people might not want to do something like take a vaccine and validate their feelings and their thoughts. And then say, you know, can I offer you some information? You know, this is what I've heard about it. I totally get where you're coming from, but here are some facts and here are some things we know, and maybe we can talk about this together. But the important thing is that it's their decision and we're not telling them what to do.
You know, Brad, I'm reminded hearing what Laura just said there of my attempts to get my 4-year-old dressed in the morning in terms of telling what to do versus trying to motivate him to do the right thing, like, oh, you know, wear pants or socks. I wonder if you can talk a little bit about, you know, what we've just heard there and, you know, this idea of confronting people versus trying to motivate them and understanding where they're coming from.
Well, I think Laura makes a great point. One of our natural reactions to being told what to do is to resist it, to say, no, you can't tell me what to do, and to want to assert our freedom and autonomy by not doing it. So I think that crafting a message that acknowledges that the target can choose otherwise, they can choose not to wear a mask, they can choose, you know, I hope they don't, but they can choose not to get a vaccine, I think can help to reduce the power of that resistance to some extent. The other thing is that for both masks and vaccines, one of the most powerful sources of potential persuasion is what our peers are doing, what the people around us are doing. If I walk into a store and everybody else is wearing a mask and I'm not, I'm going to feel pretty uncomfortable. And that social pressure is probably going to make me want to wear a mask the next time I go in. Likewise, I think one of the ways that we might be able to start persuading people in terms of a vaccine is if people who have chosen to take the vaccine and get it for their family would share that information on social media and in other ways, because then even if we may have some mistrust of leadership, especially when the leadership is not speaking with one voice, we will have this information of what our peers are doing, and that can be very influential.
You know, Jason, you've written in your book, The Soulful Art of Persuasion, this idea that we're persuading all day long, right? And I wonder if you've thought about that idea, you know, if maybe there's examples of things that we do that are persuasive or attempting to persuade that we almost just do reflexively, we don't really think about it, that we could take and apply to this idea of public health persuasion, be it on masks or the bigger issue of vaccines ahead potentially.
Yeah, I think one thing that works really well in terms of persuasion is really trying to use empathy and trying to put yourself in the other person's shoes and understand where they're coming from so that you can persuade them to have the opposite reaction. And I think when you persuade through trying to boss someone or tell them or you know, with your son, because I said so, that's not very effective. I think when you understand why they might be resistant or what the barriers are or what their point of view is, you always try to look at it from that perspective so that you can try to break down the resistance. And so that's just something I think we naturally do when we're, you know, we're persuading all day long, whether it's persuading, you know, your spouse to eat at the restaurant you want to eat at, or you're trying to get a promotion at work, or, you know, take a vacation that you want to take with your family. Those are all moments of persuasion, and we deal with those all day long. And the most effective tools and the way we do that is to empathize with the other person and try to, you know, persuade them over to our perspective. There's also, you know, when, and I know Brad would know this very well in his studies, but there's really, when you think about persuasion, there's the positive side of it and the negative side of it. And both of those can work well and be effective. You know, one is really fear-based, and it can be, you know, you can scare people into doing something. And the other, the positive aspects of persuasion is really trying to show them and convince them. And so there's different techniques, especially when we talk about mass or vaccine. You know, negative persuasion can certainly, could certainly be effective, albeit, you know, it might be politicized, so that might not work. But I think of the famous, you know, Daisy ad from the 1964 Lyndon Johnson campaign. I always love that example where there was a girl picking daisies in a field, and then there was a nuclear bomb.
Wow. Daryl. These are the stakes. To make a world in which all of God's children can live, or to go into the dark. We must either love each other, or we must die.
Vote for President Johnson on November 3rd. The stakes are too high for you to stay home.
Which was a super controversial ad, but it really helped Johnson's landslide victory over Barry Goldwater, because it was a negative form of persuasion. It was fear-based, that basically said, vote for me or you're going to get killed. And I think that can be effective in what we're talking about here, but it's not the route that I would tend to go. But I think that's another way to look at this, to sort of skin it.
This is The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're talking about public health persuasion. We started with masks. Now we're talking about vaccines. We're speaking with Jason Harris, the CEO of Mechanism, a creative ad agency, Laura Bogart, who's a behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation, and Northern Illinois University psychology professor Brad Sagarin. Jason, one of the campaigns that your agency worked on with the Obama administration was the It's On Us campaign against sexual assault. Can you talk about how that differed from previous approaches to stopping sexual assault, maybe both in how the message was relayed, who to whom it was targeted, that sort of thing?
The technique or the insight that we use, which was a little bit unique or different, is instead of looking at sexual assault as, you know, 1 in 10 freshmen and sophomore, usually females, are sexually assaulted in college. And, you know, that's incredibly high. It's 20%. And instead of doing a typical PSA or a typical campaign that would normally say, don't commit sexual assault, it'd be talking to men not to commit sexual assault, primarily men. You know, we sort of flipped that around, and going back to that sort of empathy point that I was making earlier, we created this campaign, It's On Us, which made it about all the other men that don't commit sexual assault to step in and do something and not be a bystander. So we targeted the broader group to stop sexual assault versus the group that was committing the assaults. And so that, I think, was a different way of taking the campaign that made it really effective. It was really involving everybody else, and it was a simple name, It's On Us, easy to remember, simple handle. And I think that's why it was effective, because we weren't targeting, you know, the guys that were predators. We were targeting the guys that weren't, to do something about it.
Laura, I wonder if you have any sort of final thoughts on public health persuasion here. What people ought to be doing, thinking about, you know, who they're approaching, how they're approaching this issue. You know, the simple example, the example you often we've seen these viral moments of, or you're in the grocery store, you see somebody not wearing a mask. Do you go up to them? Do you confront them? Do you, you know, shake your head or just keep your distance and protect yourself? How do you deal with that?
Thanks for asking. That's a particularly difficult situation because, as I mentioned, when people feel confronted, it's not going to change them at all. And if you're openly going up to a stranger, they may feel confronted. But also in these times, it's hard to make nice conversation and go up to people because we're supposed to distance. But I think the answer is that we need these more community-wide messages and peers talking to peers, family and friends talking to each other. And I love this idea of empathy. You know, we need to see where they're coming from, talk to them about where they're coming from, figure out why they're not doing something or maybe why they don't want to get a vaccine. And that's the only way to persuade and convince people, is to meet them where they are, talk to them, and also be a trusted source. So if it's someone, you know, if you're a family and friend of someone, then they trust you. And then you can start the conversation there. But people aren't going to listen to elected officials right now. They're hearing too many inconsistent messages. So what they need to do is hear people in their social networks and hear that message, but also hear a message of validation and knowing where people are coming from and knowing where that mistrust is coming from.
Brad, just less than a minute left, but sort of the same question to you. This idea, you know, you see somebody in the grocery store not wearing a mask. Is there anything we can do on an individual level, or are we just too far beyond that point?
If we see somebody who's not wearing a mask, I think the first thing, and I've been in that situation, is that I try to remind myself that a quick walk by somebody without a mask is very unlikely to be putting me in danger, because it can be a pretty infuriating thing. I'm doing my part. Why are they not doing their part? But I think that Laura is right. Confronting somebody is likely to just get them to resist and double down on their decision not to wear a mask. However, if I walk by and I'm friendly, then what I've done is modeled good behavior. And so I think that that can be, in the end, a much more effective way of persuading than trying to confront somebody in an angry way, as tempting as that might be.
Well, this has been a fascinating conversation. Northern Illinois University psychology professor Brad Sagarin has been with us. Laura Bogart is a senior behavioral scientist at the RAND Corporation. And Jason Harris is the CEO of Mechanism, a creative ad agency, and the author of The Soulful Art of Persuasion, The 11 Habits That Will Make Anyone a Master Influencer. Jason, Laura, and Brad, thanks so much for being with us today on the 21st.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And that's all the time we have for today. As ever, we'd love to hear what you thought about what we talked about today. You can send us an email to talk@21stshow.org. That's talk@21stshow.org. You can also tweet us @21stshow. That's @21stshow. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Eunice Alpesan's our engagement producer. She's the one who sends out our text the 21st messages and gathers and collates all those responses for us. Our intern is Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. We'll talk to you tomorrow.